Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now I got the microphone on. I'll say one more time. All right. So today's February 22nd. We got a quiz today. You're all probably aware of that. And then a take-home quiz over skeletal system, which will be pretty easy, but you got to spend some time doing it. But don't forget the test on Monday.
Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday. Yeah, you get one more day. And here, the exam figures. I've rearranged. I cut a bunch of figures off the list. All right, so figure 7.1, figure 7.11, figure 7.20 could be on the test. I could photocopy those, put them on the test, and have you label everything that's labeled on those diagrams. Furthermore, figures 7.8, A and B, 7.18, ABC, I might have some questions relating to those figures, and I'm going to talk about those figures today, but you don't have to memorize them, but if you do memorize them, then that will help you answer questions, but you're not going to have to label them. Okay, and that's because we're supposed to have two lectures on the skeletal system, but we only have time for one, so I have to cut something back. No, it's not going to be on the test. I'm sorry? Maybe a little blurry. That was on. I don't have a screwdriver. No, I got to go over what might be on the test for you. No. No. Okay. I think this is 7.1. Long bone. Let's go over a long bone. Okay. Yeah, because I can't show you a picture. I'm just going to draw on the board some things. Yeah, it's going to be epiphysis, diaphysis, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so when you have a long bone is, for instance, in your arm over here. There's one dimension that's very long compared to the right-left dimension is very short. Anterior-posterior dimension is very short as well. There's only one dimension in a long bone that's long compared to any other way. So a typical long bone looks like this. And it's got two ends, right? All right. The ends we call epiphysis. So here's an epiphysis and here's an epiphysis. And this one up over here, the one that attaches to some location of your body, we call this the proximal. And the one down over here is what we call the distal, because it's farther away from some attachment point to your body. Do you see that figure in your book, if you have your books?
Yeah.
And it's 7.1? Nice. Okay. All right, and then you got all this bone in between the epiphyses. This is what we call the diaphysis. So another name for diaphysis of a bone would be the shaft of a long bone. The shaft of a long bone. So you got the epiphyses and the diaphysis. Furthermore, on the inside of the bone, you don't have solid bone. You have little bony plates with a lot of spaces between them. And we call this spongy bone. Okay, that's spongy bone. Because it looks like what? It looks like a sponge. All right, then on the surface of the bone, right here, this is solid bone everywhere you look. That's solid bone. And solid bone we call compact. So compact bone is certainly stronger than spongy bone, but spongy bone is a lot lighter, so it doesn't require as much muscle to move it around. If all of your bone was compact bone, we probably couldn't even get up because it'd be way too heavy. Okay. Another cancellous. I don't think that's in your book. Okay. Okay. Oh, it's in the study guide? Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not going to ask that kind of question. In the very center, right here, of a long bone, there's a cavity. And whenever you have an organ, and a bone is an organ, you have a superficial part, which is called the cortex. So compact bone sometimes is called cortical bone / compact bone, because it's right on the surface. It's superficial. The deepest part of an organ is always called the medulla. Cortex is a superficial. So that cavity is called the medullary cavity, because it's deep inside the bone. But that cavity is filled with stuff. It can be filled with one or two kinds of things. It's always going to be called marrow, but the kinds of marrow, one would be yellow and the other would be red. And if it's yellow, that's just a storage form of fat or adipose tissue. If it's red, right, if it's red bone marrow, then that's for blood production. So the medullary cavity is there to make bones lighter without sacrificing strength, but it can also be filled with something, either yellow bone marrow or red bone marrow. And if it's yellow bone marrow, that's for storing fat. If it's red, then it's for making red blood cells. So, huh? Could you have both? Maybe not exactly in the same location, but it might slowly transition from one to the other. Yeah. But in somebody our age, most long bones are completely yellow bone marrow. But in younger individuals, it'll be completely red bone marrow. And where it transfers over, I'm not really sure. Yeah, so somebody intermediate age might have a little bit of everything going on in there. Okay. All right, now can you remember from... Did I go over everything on that diagram? Pretty much. Oh, except one last thing. In this region right here, there's something special going on. This is called the epiphyseal plates. The epiphyseal plate is where the bone is growing in the long direction. So you have the distal epiphyseal plate and this proximal epiphyseal plate. So bone grows in length in this direction right over here. Okay, in the long direction. And there's a lot of cartilage in this epiphyseal plate when it's growing. And what's a stronger kind of tissue, cartilage or bone? Bone is a lot stronger, right? So that if somebody, if a youngster is really horsing around, okay, and jarring their body, right, the muscles are going to push on the distal epiphysis and push on this diaphysis, and it's going to squish what? This epiphyseal plate. Okay, in which case, this epiphyseal plate is going to be damaged. And if the epiphyseal plate is damaged, guess what happens to bone growth then? Yeah, it's going to be attenuated, or maybe it's going to be stopped, or certainly it's retarded somehow. All right, and what happens to the length of this bone? Then it doesn't grow to its normal natural size. So if you have any youngsters that like to swing on these swings, you know, like we all used to do, and get to the highest point and then jump off, all right, then fly through the air, flying is really cool. Unfortunately, landing is really hard, and in particular on what? These epiphyseal plates right here. And if they're damaged, then that limb is going to be stunted in growth. And it might be just one leg or the other. It might not be bilateral, in which case one limb will be a lot longer than the other by the time you grow up. Okay, so that's an important consideration. Now, when do these epiphyseal plates ossify? A bone will stop growing at a particular time. And when it actually turns from cartilage to bone, that's when a person stops growing in height. Okay, and that happens right at puberty, or pretty close to puberty in most cases. All right, so after puberty, we're not so concerned about this epiphyseal plates because they turn to bone anyway, and you can't really damage them more than any other part of the bone. This is also interesting because you can see then, at least within a family, who is typically taller? Are the men or the women typically taller? Men are typically taller because who reaches maturity sooner? Women or men? Women do, right? So women will mature at an earlier age. These epiphyseal plates will stop growing, while a man or a boy will still won't reach maturity yet for a couple years. They'll continue growing, okay, past that age. So at least within a family, men are a little bit taller. Okay, that's not generally true across the board, but at least within a family, that's pretty true. But then again, if you're a woman, you might have a brother that's shorter with you, and that's just, you know, some genetic variation. Okay, so that's it for a long bone. Got to know the parts and those epiphyseal plates. Yeah. Okay, a plate is that three-dimensional structure that's inside the bone. But if you cut the bone, you just see that one line. Okay, so yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Okay, but the epiphyseal plate is the growth plate. But even in an adult, that area where there was a growth plate is ossified, has a lot of calcium, and it makes that little line. So I would say maybe the plate is the growing center, and the line is just where the plate was before puberty happened. Okay, let's talk about some cells. I think you learned some cells when we talk about tissue. Okay, so in this area, when the bone is growing right here, as opposed to, so let's just say this is mature bone here. Mature bone, and when we looked at connective tissue, we said what's the name of the cells that we found in mature bone? They're called osteocytes, because osteo means bone. So those are the kinds of cells that are in bone right here. But the cells that make bone are actually called, in these epiphyseal plates, osteo something, because it's bone, but osteoblast. These are osteoblasts. So osteoblasts are building bone, they're laying bone down, and then after the bone is made, they turn into osteocytes. But don't forget, as the bone is growing, okay, especially, there are other cells inside this medullary cavity right here that break bone down, that make the cavity. And the cells that make the cavity are called osteoclasts. Those are osteoclasts. So you got three types of cells. The osteocytes in mature bone. The osteoblasts, let's just say, build bone. And the osteoclasts, that's a good word. Well, it breaks bone down, but I want a word that matches with the C right here, and I can't think of one. It cannibalizes bone. It breaks it down. Osteoclasts. Okay, breaks it down. Breaks bone down. Okay, so I know there's a question on the test regarding these three cell types. All right, that's one of the study questions. Know the definition for osteocyte, osteoblast, and osteoclast. Number six. Wow, without a projector, this is really tough. No, I can't let you go home. Quiz. Huh? Yeah, let me see if there's a class next door. Oh, maybe I should just kick the socket, huh? Maybe it is the socket. No, I... Probably not. No, the fan was on. Okay. I guess I don't know how to use these machines. Okay, I thought it was pretty simple. Okay. The skeleton could be thought of as generally two different areas. So let me erase this, because this is a question on the test too. Okay, you got the whole skeleton. And the first part is what we call the axial skeleton. The second part is what we call appendicular. Skeleton. The axial skeleton contains bones of the head. Okay, bones of the head. The vertebrae or vertebral column, your ribs, and then your sternum, which is the breastbone right here. And your appendicular skeleton has to do with your appendages, namely your arms and your legs, or your upper appendage and your lower appendage. Okay. Arms and legs. I'm really close to giving this quiz. Let's see if there's anything that I can go over that makes sense. Okay, without showing you. You know, I think I'm just going to keep... It's just since the test has already run off, I can't change the test. But it's okay if you don't answer the questions. But Yeah, that's basically what I decided to do today, was just to go down through the questions. Yeah. Okay, so the questions on the test, according to the study guide right here, chapter 7, number 3, All right, so number one and number two are not on the test. So just number three. What are the parts of a typical long bone? And we went over that, right? The epiphysis and diaphysis and all that kind of stuff. Number four is not on the test. Number five is not on the test. That's pretty easy. Because number five is what kind of tissue is bone? Well, it's connective tissue. And what kind of ions are in there? What kind of minerals are in there? Well, you would say calcium, right? So that's not really difficult. Number six, that is on the test. Know the definitions for osteocyte, osteoblast, and osteoclast. Which one builds bone? That's the blast. Which one cracks it up? Oh, that's a good one. Osteoclast. And then mature bone is osteocyte. All right, bones of the axial skeleton. That's the head and the vertebrae, the ribs, are axial skeleton. And I think there's one question on that. I got number seven. What are the bones of the axial skeleton? Yep, that should be the same thing. Thoracic cage would be vertebrae and ribs. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. Hyoid bone. You know, that's a funny bone. And it's a little horseshoe-shaped bone that's up in your jaw. So it's up in this area up over here. And it's real important for swallowing and articulation. So it's an important bone, for instance, if you're going into speech pathology or something like that. But it's not a bone that typically we see, and you can't really palpate it. You can't feel it because there's so much muscle around it. And if you push hard enough to feel it, chances are you're going to break it because it's kind of delicate. Okay, but it kind of follows the contour of your mandible here. But it's inside your jaw. It's inside the jaw. Ribs, okay. Number eight. There's a question on the test regarding number eight. Your vertebral column. I'm just going to draw this out like so. Here are all the vertebrae. And there's vertebrae number one and number two. This region right here is called cervical. And that's your neck. Your cervical vertebrae are in your neck. And you have seven of them all together. The next division we call thoracic. And there are 12 of them. The next division is lumbar. And you've got five. And it's pretty easy to remember how many there are in your neck, how many there are in your thorax, and how many there are in your lumbar region. And then you also have sacral and coccygeal. Okay, which I'm not going to really talk about. Sacral, they're there. And then your tailbone are your coccygeal. But your tailbone is not real important because we don't wag it around anymore. Okay. Okay, cervical is in your neck. This first one right here is called the atlas because that's holding your head up. And remember that mythological god named Atlas, what's he doing? He's holding up the whole world. I don't know from what mythology it is, probably a number of different cultures. Atlas is holding up the head. All right. And the next one is called the axis, is number two, right over here. And those are the only ones that have names. All the rest just have numbers, like number one, number two, number three, all the way down to, which one? Yeah, number seven. And then thoracic number one, all the way down to number 12. Okay, so how can you remember cervical seven, thoracic 12, lumbar five? Yeah, because you get up, have breakfast at 7, lunch at noon, dinner at 5. Is that really stupid or what? But I know all kinds of good, stupid things to help you remember things like that. Okay? All right. I don't think that question is on the test, but you might have atlas or axis, number one or number two. They're cervical vertebrae on the test, for instance. Okay. So the axis is kind of an interesting vertebrae, and that's in, I think, this figure right here. Shows the different kind of vertebrae. Most vertebrae have a body that looks like this, and then a spine sticking out the back. So this is the body right here, and this is a spinous process. And they're flat here and here. And so another vertebrae is going to fit how? Right on top of it, like that. And another one's going to fit right on top of it, like that. Right? Except for number C2. C2 has a special spot sticking up like this. And this is what we call the dens. And it sticks up right around C1. So I'm going to put a dotted line right here because what? It's behind C1. So think of C1 as being a tire around this axle, this dens. So we have two vertebrae, okay, on top of each other with that axis or the den sticking up. And this just allows these two vertebrae to rotate around each other. So the dens allows you to do this kind of motion. This is a no motion, that's a rotation. Okay, because of the dens that's sticking up, those two vertebrae can just rotate right around each other. Let's talk about ribs for just a second. I think that is maybe this diagram right here. Okay, by definition, where does a rib attach? It attaches to a thoracic vertebrae. And if you have 12 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs? You're going to have 12. So a rib can only attach to a thoracic vertebrae. If you have, and this happens not too infrequently, but it does happen, maybe you only have 11 ribs. How many thoracic vertebrae do you have? You know what? Then, by definition, you have 11. Okay, so there's got to be a one-to-one correspondence between the number of ribs that you have and the number of thoracic vertebrae. So if you're missing the 12th rib, then you're missing this 12th vertebrae here as well. You don't get an extra rib anywhere. The first five, 1 through 5, are what we call true ribs. And the remaining are what we call false ribs. Because these true ribs, if we look now at an anterior diagram of somebody, this is their breastbone right here. And the breastbone we call the sternum. And does anybody know what this little piece, this inferior little piece sticking off the sternum is called? That's a xiphoid process. Xiphoid process. And when people undergo CPR, they got to be concerned about that little xiphoid process because it can break off the sternum and can go into your liver and lacerate the liver, for instance. I might have the xiphoid process on the test. Xiphoid process is part of the sternum right here. Well, a true rib, namely these first five, attach directly to the sternum, like this. These are true. So these are the true ribs right here. False ribs are going to come around to the back, or from the back, but they're going to attach to rib number 5, not directly to the sternum. So this would be what, like number 6 and number 7. Number 8. right, 9, 10, are going to attach via cartilage to rib number 5. So these, since they don't attach directly to the sternum, we call these false ribs. Furthermore, you got two more, right? Because we only got two, 9, okay, and 10. There are two additional ribs, number 11 and 12. They don't attach at all. They're just floating. They don't attach to any other ribs or to the sternum. So these are what we call floating ribs. Okay. Floating ribs are also false. So not all false ribs are floating, only the posterior, or only the inferior two are floating. So the superior 5 are true, the inferior 7 are false, and furthermore, the most inferior 2 are called floating ribs because they don't attach to any ribs whatsoever. They're back over here. So if somebody gives you a big, strong bear hug, these are the ones that you can actually break, right? Because they're not very strong. They're not attached to anything. Okay, true rib versus false rib. That's number 9. So a true rib is what? Attached directly to the sternum, and a false rib is not directly attached to the sternum. And I think maybe there's a question about the sternum on the test and maybe that xiphoid process. Which leads me to think of, when we name bumps on bones, there is something called a process. Okay, a process. It's a bump on a bone. Like when I drew this thing, this spiny process sticking off the body of a vertebrae, I called it a process. The function of a process is always muscle attachment. So process is muscle attachment. There's another thing on a bone. For instance, if we have a bone right here and there's a hole in it, we don't call it a hole. We give it a special other name. We call it a foramen. And that's got a different function. So if you ever read something foramen and somebody asks you what's the function of that particular foramen, you don't have to know specifically what's going on there, but just like if anybody asks you what's the function of this particular process, you immediately would say muscle attachment. All right, but if it's a foramen, it's a passageway for something. And plural, right, we would say a. Foramina would be plural for foramen. It's F-O-R and then A. F-O-R-A-M-E-N, foramen. And then foramina for plural. So in general, I could ask you, what's the function of a transverse foramen? You've never heard of a transverse foramen, but you would just say, well, it's a passageway, because it's a hole in a bone. It's a passageway for maybe a nerve going through the bone, or a blood vessel going through a bone, maybe even a muscle going through a bone. Okay. But if we say, what's the function of a process, you wouldn't say passageway, you would say muscle attachment. Okay. Number 11, appendicular skeleton. You got to look at that figure. I think it's this one right here that shows the bones of the appendicular versus the axial skeleton. So look at that. The last thing on that diagram is, so here is What's that? That's your skull. That's your head, right? Here is your vertebral column. And your ribs. Oops. Something like this. Right? And your sternum with your xiphoid process right there. Right? So that's all axial skeleton. Now what about this right here? And this right here? And this here? What skeleton is that? That's the appendicular skeleton. These are your appendages, right? Your arms and your legs. Right here. So your skeleton is made of axial versus appendicular. And then you have a couple bones that attach your appendicular skeleton to the axial skeleton. For instance, in this region right here and this region right here. Those have got special little names. And these are what we call girdles. So a girdle attaches appendicular skeleton to axial skeleton. Appendicular to axial. That's a girdle. And you got two. The ones up over here in your shoulder are what we call the pectoral girdle. And the one down over here, does anybody know what that thing is called? That's the pelvic girdle. So somewhere on your test, it's got a question. It probably is going to ask maybe, what are the bones of the pectoral girdle or what are the bones of the pelvic girdle? Okay, and I don't know which question it is, but the pectoral girdle is made of the scapula and the clavicle. And your clavicle you can feel pretty easy. That's this bone right up over here. And your scapula is in the back. So take a look at a picture of where the scapula and clavicle are. Right, the pelvic girdle are your hip bones. But we don't call them hip bones. They got a different name. They're called your os coxae. So your pectoral girdle is your clavicle and scapula, and your pelvic girdle is your hip bones or your os coxae. So the girdles really aren't part of the axial skeleton or the appendicular skeleton. They attach the two together. That's number 11. Number 14. Know the characteristics of a synovial joint. Okay, synovial joint. There are different kinds of joints. Some joints are immovable. Like there are joints between the bones of your head. And they don't move. That's not a synovial joint. But your shoulder is a good example of a synovial joint. Because you have a huge range of motion. So a synovial joint is freely movable. So what's the function of a process? Muscle attachment. What's the function of a foramina? Passageway, okay. All right, so what was I talking about? Synovial joints. All right, well I didn't say what a joint is yet. What the heck is a joint? A joint is an articulation or a connection between two bones. Right, so if you have one bone and another bone where they come together, right, that's a joint. And some joints are immovable. Other joints are freely movable. Freely movable joints are what we call synovial. So what's a good example of a synovial joint? Like the shoulder. Your hip are synovial joints. And these are an interesting kind of synovial joint. For instance, in the scapula, this is going to be scapula right here, I'll write bigger, there is a big depression, okay? And in that depression, the head of a long bone fits in. So this looks like a socket, and this thing right here looks like what? A ball. So this kind of joint, a shoulder and a hip, is called a ball and socket joint, and it just allows for a lot of degrees of motion, right? So you can do almost anything with your shoulder and your hips because it's a ball and socket joint, as opposed to a finger. That's not a ball and socket. That's just a hinge that can only go backwards and forwards, okay, back and forth. And if you bend it any other which way, what does that mean? Something's going to break, okay? But a nice thing about a ball and socket, you can move it any which way and nothing's going to break. Okay, so a finger joint is still synovial because it's what? Freely movable. But it's not a ball and socket. Your knee is another example. What kind of joint is your knee? Okay, it's synovial, it's freely movable, but again, it's not ball and socket, it's what? It's just a hinge joint. Okay, it's a hinge. That joint between C1 and C2 over here, cervical 1 or cervical 2, atlas and axis, that's not a hinge joint, right? That's what we call a pivot joint because it just allows for rotation. So there are different kinds of joints. But again, that would be a synovial joint because it's what? It's freely movable. Okay, so for number 15, I want you to know that a ball and socket is a synovial joint, right? Like your shoulder and your hip. There's another kind of joint that none of us have, but newborns have, neonates have. There are special joints between the bones of their head, right? Because the bones of their head are not completely formed. And it's a good thing that a neonate's head can actually deform quite a bit as it's getting squished out the birth canal. So it's good for the baby and good for the mom, right? So the head can deform a little bit. It can compress, come out the birth canal. And those joints are formed by membranes. And what do we call those membranous spots in a neonate's head that are very soft? Yeah, they're soft spots. That's definitely what we call them. Common, but there's a scientific name for them too. So soft spot certainly is one, right? But that's the exact same thing as a fontanelle. A fontanelle. And does anybody know about how long fontanelles can stick around in a neonate? Yeah, it could be as long as 2 years. So that's way past being a newborn. So you got to be really careful with these little kids because they have those soft spots. They don't have a hard cranium to protect their brain for maybe as long as 2 years. So any kind of shaking, right, can be very damaging to their nervous system. Or any kind of puncturing is certainly very damaging. All right, and in your book, you have a nice picture of a fontanelle, a number of fontanelles. In a neonate's head. There's a little dog that has fontanelles their whole life. Does anybody know? Huh? Yeah, chihuahuas have fontanelles their whole life. They're kind of interesting. So, Well, I probably wouldn't want to have a chihuahua and have him play with a Rottweiler or a Doberman or something. Okay, because just a little slip of a canine from the Doberman could go right through the head of that chihuahua because it doesn't have a hard cranium in that spot. Yeah, so, and of course, any kind of trauma, shaking or whatever, they would be susceptible. Yeah. Okay. Ball and socket. Ball and socket. Freely movable joint. Yeah, so if you see a question about which kind of joint is freely movable, you know what? A ball and socket is freely movable. Your shoulder and hip. Your shoulder and hip are the only two examples of ball and socket joints that you have.
But aren't they all synovial?
Are all joints synovial?
No, like all the ones right here listed, and
number 15. So all the ones that I've listed, yeah, plane and gliding, a pivot, a hinge, ellipsoid, saddle, are synovial joints. But there's no way I can show you how those work, except hinges are easy. Okay. An example of a saddle joint would be your thumb. Right? Your thumb you can move like this, but you can also move like that. So your thumb joint is a little bit more complex. It's not just a hinge, but it's not quite as movable as, what, a ball and socket. But it's getting there. Okay, the last thing that I want to talk about is motion that's produced, different kinds of motions in your body. Okay, and that's number 17. So 16, well, 16 are things that work against each other. Okay, antagonism. And we talked about three kinds of bone cells. What were those three kinds of bone cells again? Osteo something. Osteoblasts, build bone, and what kind break bone down? Clasts. The clasts break it down. The blasts build it up. So these two are working what? Against each other because they do opposite things. Those cells are what we call antagonistic to each other. Okay, so the clast and the blast are antagonistic. Right? Osteo, blast is antagonistic to what? The osteoclast. Because that breaks bone down, that builds bone up. And those two cells are always working in our bodies all the time. So once your body builds a bone, it's not there forever. As a matter of fact, all the bones in your body are completely replaced every 5 years. So that just shows you what? That the osteoblasts are very busy and the osteoclasts are very busy. And if you have healthy bones, then there's a balance between the two. And what's the name of that process where there's an imbalance in these two cells? Maybe the osteoclasts get too busy and the osteoblasts can't keep up with them. What's that called? That's called osteoporosis. Right? So there's some kind of imbalance that happens to everybody if we're lucky enough to live long enough, but particularly women. Okay? That imbalance seems to show up a little bit more, and especially women who have very thin bones as opposed to women who have thicker bones. And one way to protect yourself if you're a woman from osteoporosis is that any kind of exercise that you do has a tendency to build bone up. So good diet, premenopausally, where you have good calcium in your diet, good vitamin D, and exercise will protect you from osteoporosis later on in life. Okay. But if you're fortunate enough to be a woman with big, strong bones, then you don't have to worry quite so much about osteoporosis. Okay. But even men get osteoporosis, and every woman will to some degree. Okay. So that's antagonism. Along the lines of antagonism, certain kinds of motion. Flexion and extension. Let's talk about flexion and extension as kinds of motion. All right, if we think of your arm, all right, especially at the elbow right here, you have bones in the forearm and bones in the arm. If we decrease the angle between your forearm and arm, that's what we call flexion. So decreasing the angle is flexion. If we increase the angle between these bones, that's what we call extension. So flexion and extension are opposite terms, and you know what? They're antagonistic to each other as well. Right? So flexion opposes extension, and extension opposes flexion. I think maybe there's a question on the test regarding flexion and extension. Okay, so this would be a good example. So what's this motion right here that I'm doing now? Boom. That's flexion. And when I increase that angle, that is extension. If you have your hand like this, what is this motion? That's flexion. Yeah, flexion. And this would be extension. So flexion and extension. You can flex your vertebral column. I can't really do that anymore. But if you contract your stomach muscles and you bend your vertebral column like this, okay, that is flexion of your vertebral column. But if you stand up straight like that, that is extension, right? So flexion or extension of your vertebral column. What about your leg? What is this motion right here, going like this?
Flexion.
That's flexion, and this is extension, right? So that's not too hard to know. Maybe one more, adduction and abduction. If you have your limbs and you move your limbs away from your body, this is abduction with a B, abduction. All right, but if you bring your limbs toward your body, you can do that with your legs too. Okay, bring your feet together, that's adduction. So abduction, adduction. So adduction is when you add things together, when you bring things together is adduction. When you bring things apart, that's abduction. You can abduct and adduct your fingers as well. And I think maybe you saw that when I was working with the fingers, right? When you spread your fingers apart, what's that called? Abduction. And when you bring your fingers together, that is adduction. And you can do that with your toes too, right? You can abduct and adduct your toes back and forth. All right, so you can abduct, adduct. And what's this again? That's flexion, extension. Okay, flexion and extension. And those are what we call antagonistic motions. Okay, those others, maybe I might go over sometime because they're interesting, because a lot of people hurt joints by making their body do things that those joints aren't supposed to do. We talked about rotation. The bone in your upper arm is called the humerus, right? We said flexion and extension. But if you flex your forearm and bring your forearm over like this, we can get the humerus to rotate, right? So I'm not flexing or extending. I'm just rotating the humerus right here. So this would be a lateral rotation, a medial rotation. A lot of people have trouble with their shoulder called rotator cuff injury. It's a problem with rotation at the shoulder. And a good clinical sign, a good test for a rotator cuff injury is when they try to do a lateral rotation, if there's resistance, when you put resistance to a lateral rotation, that produces excruciating pain in the shoulder. That would be a nice sign of a rotator cuff tear. All right, so knowing motions of joints, you just run into it all the time. Okay. Well, I got a quiz for you. Which figures you got to know? You got to know 7-1, 7-11, 7-20.
Is that the one in the box? No?
1 is, 11 is, but 20 is not. I want you to add 20, but I want you to delete 16 and 3, right? Yeah, delete 7.16. Delete 7.13. But now if you looked at those, that will help you on the test, but it's not absolutely crucial.
But we need to know 4.7, 5.1, 5.2.
Yeah, you still need 4.7, 5.1, 5.2, 5.3, 5.5, and 6.1. Okay.